Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
All right. Welcome, Dr. Esther Van Wagner. You're an associate professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Victoria. Thanks for speaking to me today. So you're a professor at the UVic Law School, and some of your research has specialized in Aboriginal title, Indigenous property, and land use systems. Can you just talk a bit about your background there?
Sure. Thanks very much for having me and inviting me to talk about this. So I am a property law professor, and one of the kind of strands of my research is really about this intersection of the common law and Indigenous law in terms of decision-making about land use and environmental impacts and natural resource development. So I have a project that's actually based on Vancouver Island to try to think through some of the complications of places where there haven't been treaties negotiated, where there's a kind of mixture of fee simple and crown land and Indigenous land rights, and what we should do to move forward in those places and to live together in a good way.
So in August, a decision was handed down in BC Supreme Court in a land claim case by the Cowichan Tribes, which is the same as the Cowichan Nations. Cowichan Tribes sounds like a very old-fashioned term, but all about a parcel of land on the Fraser River in Richmond, and the sort of outcome of that case raised alarms and continues to be a source of discussion here in the province. What was that land decision?
So that case is a the resolution of a long-standing claim to Aboriginal title to a very small area in the south part of the Fraser River, where the Cowichan Nation has traditionally had a fishing village and very important cultural connections to that place, in addition to the territories that they have on Vancouver Island. So the group of nations that together have called themselves the Cowichan Nation Alliance for the purposes of bringing this have for many, many generations taken issue with the fact that areas of their territory on the Fraser were granted away to settlers without any compensation, without any treaty, without any consultation. And so Aboriginal title claims are one way that nations in a situation like that can pursue a legal remedy for those historic wrongs. So this case decided that the Cowichan Nation had in fact made out that claim and declared their Aboriginal title to the territory, to a portion, not the full area that they had claimed, but to a portion of that area. And it did so with two different kind of effects. So there's some areas of the title claim where the title is held by the Crown or the City of Richmond, so government entities. And in those places, the declaration of Aboriginal title was made, and it was also found that the title of Canada and Richmond was invalid, and that title is returned to the Cowichan Nation member nations. But there's another area, part of the area, where it's individual fee simple holders, not Crown or government entities. And in that area, the fee simple title held by those persons or companies was not found to be invalid. And that was not requested by the nations. So that wasn't a remedy that they were seeking.
Right. So is that distinction, though, because part of what I hear when I hear that is that those private property fee simple rights weren't affected in part because they weren't part of the claim. So
they were part of the claim.
Yeah.
So they were part of the claim in the sense that Aboriginal title was declared for the area encompassing both the government entities and the private fee simple holders.
Mm-hmm.
But the remedy for that was different for certain portions of the claimed area than others. So where there were those government entities holding a fee simple title, there was a request by the nations to have those titles declared invalid, which will facilitate the return of those lands. Mm-hmm. But the nations did not request that same remedy with respect to the private fee simple holders. And so the court did not declare them invalid. And so it has a very different effect on the future of those property holders.
So does that mean that in a different case or in a future case, that remedy could be requested and that question remains unresolved?
So what it means is that the Cowichan Nation has the underlying Aboriginal title and it coexists with the fee simple. We don't have yet a clear picture what that means, so the end parties could go to court and ask to clarify that, and it is possible for the nations to ask for a different kind of remedy vis-a-vis other parcels of land, but that has not been done, and it is not at all clear what the outcome would be. There are different kinds of considerations and different factual aspects of the history of those different parcels and who's holding them now that would be considered by the court. So it's certainly not a foregone conclusion that you would end up in the same situation. We simply don't know, but the parties would have the right to go to court and ask for remedies or ask for clarification. But the court has made it very clear that, in fact, it is the Crown's job to facilitate a solution for the coexistence of those interests. So the Cowichan Nation hasn't done anything wrong by asking for clarification of their title to these areas and righting the historic wrongs of interest being granted without their consent or any compensation or consultation, that it was the Crown's wrong. And so the Crown should be doing work to figure out how to reconcile those interests. And in fact, this government has done some really creative things in terms of figuring out what the relationship between Crown and Indigenous interests and even third-party interests in the context of places like Haida Gwaii. So we know that it is possible to think creatively and find transformative solutions, but we have yet to see the Crown take those steps in this case.
So a short way of saying what the court said is that they're telling that the appropriate way for the government to deal with this is through negotiation rather than letting things work their way through the courts.
Yes,
okay,
that's right.
So one thing I've read about this case that, and I'm wondering how significant this is that one aspect of it is that this area of land was in fact previously granted to the Cowichan in some sort of claim. And then, again, this is what I've read online with different stories, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've basically kind of defrauded out of that land again by either the government or the land commissioner, so it could ultimately be resold. That is that something that you've heard?
There is a very convoluted history of this land, but I think the really important, simple version is that this is historically that on the facts, the court found that it clearly is historically territory of the Cowichan Nation, and that any of the decisions, the grants that had been made were done. It was done unlawfully, and so that gets us to the situation now where the Aboriginal title still coexists. It was never extinguished lawfully, and there certainly were some very problematic dealings by agents of the Crown, and some of that. It's a very complex. That's why the decision is 800 pages long. But I think the important thing would be that Aboriginal title is not recognition of a prior grant of the land or anything like that. It's a recognition of the historic, pre-existing, inherent right of the nation because of their occupation and use and relationship to that land. So it's not really about, how those dealings happen to either recognize Cowichan's territory in the past in that sense through any kind of grant. It's about that historic pre-existing relationship with the territory and governance of the territory that's being recognized. So Aboriginal title doesn't create those rights, and they're not derived from the Crown in any way. It recognizes that inherent relationship to the land.
Right. So let's talk a bit about Aboriginal title then, because you've talked about how it coexists with fee simpler private property rights. So there's Aboriginal title here. There's the Crown lands, which is a kind of ownership sim. There's the provinces and the federal government sort of sovereignty over this territory we call British Columbia and Canada. How do those things relate?
Sure. I mean, I'm teaching property right now. I'll sort of teach this for the whole year, so this will be a very simplified mini version of. But there's different ways of recognizing property relations. So the Crown has certain kinds of lawmaking power with respect to land that flows from the Constitution, and the province and the federal government have that for their respective Crown lands. And then there's also ownership of rights of the Crown for their respective lands and the ability to make certain decisions by virtue of that ownership. And in the case of the province, that's recognized by Section 109 of the Constitution. And in that section, it says subject to any other interests. And it's clear from the case law that Aboriginal title is one of those interests that the provincial crown land holding and powers associated with are subject to. So even the crown doesn't have that kind of unlimited property right. All of the property rights outside of the protected Section 35 Aboriginal title rights in the Canadian legal system are derived of the crown. So I just taught my property students about this. We exist in an estate system that's derived from the tenurial system. And so we still in Canada hold our property of the crown. There's no absolute ownership in our system. The crown has an underlying title, and we get a kind of what we refer to it as in property law as a slice of time in the land. And fee simple represents one of the largest sets of rights that we associate with an estate in land, but it's always of the crown. And as this decision makes clear, those interests are not absolute. We decide to limit them in a bunch of different ways, including municipal zoning, including environmental regulations. And Aboriginal title, while it is the common law's way of understanding the Indigenous interests in land rooted in pre-existing societies being here, governing those places, having relationships with those places, it is unique because it's not derived from the crown like those other interests. So its content, what is being recognized there, is not simply an indigenous version of a fee simple. It's unique and it is sourced in a very different way. And that goes into some of what was decided in the decision, that the recognition of Aboriginal title is not subject to things like the Land Titles Act, because it's not a crown derived interest. So it is regulated and limited, while not absolute. The limitations that apply to it are unique from the limitations that apply to fee simple.
All right. Well, that does a pretty good job. So they're really quite different origins, and that is a lot of the basis for how they operate differently.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's important to recognize that Aboriginal title is not something that comes from or is a representation of any particular Indigenous legal order. It's very much the Canadian common law's way of trying to reconcile the fact that there is an extinguished, pre-existing relationships with the territory that have to be recognized, that have not been lawfully dealt with. And so we have to have some legal way of reconciling the Crown's interest in the land and actions in relation to the land with that Indigenous interest in the land. And once Aboriginal title is declared, that relationship becomes unique in Canadian property relations.
A term I often hear related to this is about the extinguishment of Aboriginal title. But the way you describe it doesn't really sound like there's even a need to extinguish Aboriginal title for things, for the various components to work together.
So extinguishment was historically sought by the Crown, and we see historic treaties in different parts of Canada as attempts to do that. Now, I would caution that I think the many Indigenous signatories of different historic treaties would say that those treaties did not, in fact, and I think there's lots of historic evidence, but nonetheless, that was one effort to do that. But by the time Canada entered, or BC entered into the terms of the Union to join Canada, there was a policy that simply said, well, Indigenous interests in land don't exist. And there were no treaties negotiated apart from a very small number of treaties on Vancouver Island. And that attempt to erase these legal relations with land that in other places had at least been kind of perfunctorily recognized through treaties has left BC in a particularly complex situation, because it now means that it's the site of this these very complicated legal actions where Aboriginal title was never really addressed in the settlement of the territory and the development of the territory. Once Section 35 and the 1982 Constitution was enacted, it's not possible anymore to extinguish Aboriginal title or Aboriginal rights. So now it has to be dealt with through a framework that the courts have established called a justified infringement. And so that's part of the analysis that you'd see in that case. Right. But a very important part of this case is looking historically at the way that extinguishment could and couldn't happen. And in fact, the province did not have the authority to extinguish Aboriginal title or Indigenous rights and interests in land. Only the Dominion and then the federal government was able to do that. And so a huge issue that arises in the context of BC is that these actions were taken without authority to lawfully transform land into feasible or into crown land and grant third-party interests. So in this case, there was a really detailed dive into what the context of those grants to understand whether they were done lawfully and whether there was authority, because the province, its denial of Aboriginal title as a policy position doesn't actually change the law as much as they would have liked it to.
Right. So throughout the province, there are many, many land claims from many nations covering and often overlapping. And within all those land claims, there is lots and lots of private property and crown land. What does this decision mean for all that? And is it something that the courts are even going to be able to handle, or, you know, is it going to be down to negotiation?
I think this case makes clear, and in fact, all Aboriginal title cases, I mean, we've really only seen this go to the Supreme Court and have a final determination of this in the case of the Sokoteen. So it's a pretty rare occurrence at this point in time. But in that case, and in some of the other relevant cases, we have seen the fee simple private property holders carved out. So we didn't necessarily see those issues dealt with because the plaintiffs chose not to deal with those issues at some point in their decision making. So what's happening in this case is not kind of the creation of new law or new kind of precedent. It's just applying it to a different fact scenario. And I think that that's really lost in a lot of the conversation here. And I think that that's creating some of the kind of alarmist dialogue that's happening, is that this isn't new law. It's a fact scenario that the court was asked to deal with, and it applied the law as it existed through those cases that have made it through the courts before to a situation in which the nations included a bunch of different parcels of land. So every single Aboriginal title case is going to be dealt with in a very specific case-by-case factual basis. The facts here are, you know, hundreds of pages long in determining what actually happened, when the land was transferred, what kind of surveys had occurred, who had seen who dealing with the land. Every case is going to have that kind of scenario. So there's no way to predict that this factual finding in this case and the legal decision that follows from that means anything in particular. Right. And this case didn't create the possibility that this legal framework of Aboriginal title could be applied to fee simple. That's, anyone who's worked in this area has known that this issue has been around forever and was bound to come to the courts, and in fact has been in the courts in various ways at particular moments. This isn't even the first case to raise it as a potential issue. And we have actually seen the Crown kind of fail to be proactive about this and address it. And so the fact that this is a surprise to some is really at the hands of the Crown and not ensuring that people are informed and that they're rolling out a process to make sure that these conversations are happening in a good way. You know, I think there's a tremendous amount to be taken from the fact that the Cowichan Nation did not ask for a declaration of invalidity of those other private holdings, and that many claims have excluded those before, because these are their neighbors. These are their communities, right? They're seeking justice of a historic wrong, but not by creating further wrongs, by trying to figure out how we can all be good neighbors to each other and find ways through that are bringing together Cowan law and the common law and perhaps creating something entirely new. To me, this is an opportunity to think about, well, what do we want to create that is of this place, right? Do we need frameworks that have come from England to tell us how we should be neighbors with each other and how we should interface with these lands? You know, perhaps there's things we want to take from that, but perhaps there's things we want to take from Cowan law about what it means to live here and be good neighbors to each other. I think if folks took the opportunity to actually learn about Cowan law or other Indigenous legal orders, there would probably be a lot of comfort in the fact that these governance models and frameworks have been dealing with issues of conflict and overlapping interests and how to manage land and territory for many, many generations, and have tools that we can, as non-Indigenous peoples, perhaps link into and find ourselves learning from as we figure out these complicated questions.
So sort of to finish up, you know, if I understand it for everything you've said to me, and it's been a lot.
Yes, sorry. There's a lot to say.
You know, the way forward on this, kind of in the long run, because it sounds like it will be a long run, is is that, you know, within our legal system and understanding of property rights, Aboriginal title needs to be integrated into that, kind of in the same way that, you know, the provincial, and federal sovereignty and the rights of municipalities, because there are already very sort of influences in and ways in which the different bodies have some say in what happens on this kind of land. And this is not something completely different and not in opposition, just, well, I wouldn't say new, but newly considered in that larger equation.
Yeah, I think this makes clear that the intersocietal and multi-juridical space that we're living in has to be faced head on, that we have to address the fact that this is a place in which different legal orders are intersecting. And at times that's going to create opportunities, and at times it's going to create challenges. But I think really expecting all of us to enter into it in good faith and in a good way will lead to better outcomes and solutions than the kind of alarmist and fear-based thinking that we've seen from a lot of parties. And so I hope that folks will, you know, read the case and talk to people with knowledge of the history and of Cowan law and try to inform themselves about what a different future might look like for those places.
Well, that seems like a great place to end it for today. Thanks so much for speaking to me. It really is a very complex issue, but, you know, I think a lot of that complexity is sort of lost in the more in a lot of the discussion that goes on. And I think if we can cut through that complexity, it isn't as scary as it sometimes seems.
Yeah.
But it's also a lot of work to be done by all the parties.
Absolutely. A lot of work to be done. And I think, you know, the hope is that we can turn a page here and start doing that together rather than in opposition to each other.
Well, Dr. Esther Van Wagner, thank you so much. Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law at UVic. Very enlightening conversation today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad you're covering this issue.
Good. Thank you.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2. Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented.